Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by It's for Women. Discover female health insurance through It's for Women.
Now, welcome back. The Monaghan family of Shane O'Farrell, who was killed in a 2011 hit and run, have said the public apology from the government this week was a day of vindication after many long years of campaigning. Shane's mother, Lucia O'Farrell, is an incredible woman, and she's been described as a woman who refused to take no for an answer for 13 years, 9 months and 20 days and counting. Lucia O'Farrell is on the phone. Good morning, Lucia.
Good morning, Oliver.
How are you?
Well, I was very tired last night because the previous night I didn't really sleep very well. So I had a restless night. So last night I slept well. So, you know, they have apologised, which is a significant step. It's an acknowledgement of the institutional failure which exposed Shane to danger. And, you know, Mr O'Callaghan gave that apology, tarnished, and the Taoiseach spoke prior to that. And they reiterated what he had said. And the minister said the justice system that exposed, that operated at the time, exposed Shane to a threat that he should not have been exposed to. And the failings in our justice system that exposed Shane to danger on that fateful day. I'm just quoting from his statement here in front of me.
Yeah.
And he apologised to Shane. And I think that was very important for our family, that it wasn't just an apology to us. It was an apology to Shane and of our family for the fact that the criminal justice system did not operate, did not protect Shane as it should have. And I do so apologise. So that's, you know, very significant and profound, really.
It took a very long time and some long, lonely days where you probably thought it may not happen. Or did you always believe that it would occur, that you'd get this public apology because you fought and fought and fought?
Well, we knew early on things weren't just right, but we couldn't get any information. And so very bit by bit, I mean, it was a huge, long struggle. We might find, it was like a piece of a jigsaw. You might find the last piece first and then a piece from the middle, and things didn't add up. And it was relentless, because we'd get a bit and it would give us maybe encouragement to find another piece. And we started to piece things together, and then people were very kind and they approached us, said, you know, telling us bits and pieces and phoning us up and said, I knew the man who killed your son. He was in the paper all the time, both sides of the border. And we went then to the various libraries and looked up the Northern Standard, our local newspaper here, the Anglo Celt, the Dundalk Democrat, to get a kind of a chronology of his crime prior to the 2nd of August. And we could see this litany of crime. And he seemed to be getting bail, breaching bail, getting bail.
And we're just listening to you here, Lucia, and you sound kind of like you've become a lawyer in the meantime. You sound like you're the head of an advocacy group, do you know? And this is what it's kind of done to your family, hasn't it?
I'm actually a retired nurse, and I think I have less in common now with my former colleagues than I do with other victims' families, who would ring up each other and rely on each other to say, what should I do now and where should I go? And actually, one of Shane's lecturers in UCD, which has been lovely and kind, and she has said, you've a law degree and master's in law at this stage. I had to research, Oliver. I had to research what should have happened, because in nursing, if a valve in a heart doesn't work, then you know what happens following that. So I had to apply that same thing. What should have happened and then what didn't happen.
Right.
So we went through that for the 14 years looking, almost 14 years now on the 2nd of August, looking for answers. And we had to get them ourselves, which is very difficult if you're trying to grieve your healthy child who was killed by someone who shouldn't have been at liberty.
Yeah.
And so, you know, they've now put their hands up and said, sorry, you know, this shouldn't have happened and the system failed Shane and he was put in danger. But they haven't answered why.
I met your one of your daughters last year, Gemma, and she was telling me about Shane. He was only 23 years of age, people will know by now. He was out training for a triathlon at the time, wasn't he?
That's right. And he had just finished college, Trinity, and he went out. He'd been training all year and he was, you know, a very good swimmer. He was a good athlete. He loved rugby. He was passionate about rugby. And part of the triathlon, as people would know, was a cycle. So this was the last cycle before the event that would take place in Clare. Mm. So he went out and his sister said, would you like... his sister said, they'll have a cup of tea. And he said, I'll have one when I come back. And he never came home. And, you know, his whole life was ahead of him, or should have been. All the study done, you know, his law degree and master's of law in the bag. He loved the guitar and the piano. He just loved people. He loved life. He loved making tea and toast. he loved to chat with people. You know, when he was over in London visiting his girlfriend, he would go down, you know, the markets and Bar Market in Camden, and he, you know, ostrich, whatever was being sold, he would have a chat with the people that were running the market, maybe the African man that had 10 children, and he would enjoy that. He just loved people, and he was very good with people. They kind of, he drew people to him, and he was interested in their lives, and he was fascinated with, you know, language and English and life. He loved life. He was just a beam of life.
He was a man of the world, but he was particularly proud of Monaghan, wasn't he? And talked about Monaghan when he's in Dublin a lot.
He came home. Everyone in UCD and Trinity knew about Carrick and Cross because he spoke about it so often. And every weekend he came home, because some of his friends that didn't go to UCD, they might have went to the DKIT in Dundalk, he would meet up with them and they'd play pool and they'd have the crack, etc. And then they'd all get their T-shirts washed and go back to college on the bus, on the Collins' bus back up to Dublin. Mm. So he adored Carrick and Cross. And we live here just on the outskirts, and there's a big estate, an old English estate, Shirley's estate. And he would sit on the bench and play his guitar and watch the birds coming and going into the woods and see the leaves changing and the seasons. And he just loved nature. You know, he was such a joy. When he would come home at the weekend and the girls would come home, and we have a table that has seven sides on it, and of course there's one spot now missing, Jane's missing from that spot, but they would be chatting about the weekend, about boys and girls and whatnot in college, the usual crack children, teenagers have when they come home from college. Yeah. And I would be kind of thrown an ear in, and then they'd realise I was listening and they'd all start talking French. And I thought, oh, I can't know now what they're saying. You know, he was a breath of fresh air, and he's just... So it would have been a huge betrayal, Oliver, I felt, not to find out why this happened and why this man was at liberty. Yeah. You know, it was, you know, we needed to do that. I felt that needed to happen.
I read, Lucia, that you go to the graveyard every day.
Yes, I haven't missed a day, yes. Sometimes more often, Oliver. I mean, that's where they placed him, you know, that's where... He is, and he should be here. He should be living his life. He should be in New Zealand. Or, you know, we hear mothers sometimes on the radio saying, you know, they haven't seen him for 3 years. They're in New Zealand or Canada. And we haven't seen Shane since the 2nd of August. Now, he had planned to go travelling with his girlfriend, and they had never been, you know, travelling. And she had said to him, will we travel the world now for a year? And he said, oh, a year is a long time. Our family are very close. We will go, but not maybe for that long.
But it's lovely to talk and to hear you talking about your love for Shane, and every single day I'm going to the graveyard. Do you chat to him there? What do you do when you go?
I do, and I seek his advice. And but, you know, we've had, since that time, our daughters have got married, and, you know, you're at the wedding and you look on at the dance floor and you're thinking, you should be down there dancing. Oh, he should be up at the bar having a pint, you know. So when they've had children, you think, God, he'd love to embrace the uncle role, and he'd be showing them how to spin the ball with rugby or how to play the guitar. And he should maybe be a parent himself, or, you know, gather money for a mortgage for a house. All the normal things that, you know, should have been there for him. But, you know, there's chapters of Shane's life now unwritten forever, and that's not fair.
No. Look, grief is its own thing. Can I ask you, though, about the anger you have that we can hear? And it's obviously a force that kept you going too. Is there any healing for that?
I suppose, yes. Solicitor said that to me a long time ago. You're very angry. And he said, don't lose that anger. And I think the anger... I channeled my grief into the anger of, like, this is so unacceptable, and Shane can't do anything about this now, and he has no voice. And I started, when I couldn't sleep at night at 3 or 4 in the morning, I was on the computer. I was researching the law. I was, you know, sending emails maybe that people thought, gosh, she was up at that hour of the night. And so it gave me a purpose, I suppose, as well.
But you've done so much now, and you've achieved what you set out to achieve so far.
Well, not completely, really, Oliver. Right. I suppose you have to do what's right in your heart, or you'll be criticised anyway. You know, you have to do what's right in your heart. Yes, we know, and at long last, they've put their hands up and said, you know, Shane was put in danger, and he was, and that's very obvious. And of course, we're delighted that there's a memorial now in UCD for future students. So
that's lovely. Yeah,
Shane's legacy will live on in UCD,
that's
and
a scholarship.
It'll be a wonderful gift from him talking to students who otherwise might not have had the opportunity offered to them. So that's a huge tribute, and the law will be changed. Gemma has already got the law changed that prior to Shane's death, leaving the scene of the fatal collision was a summary offence, and she lobbied with Fianna Fáil at the time, and the law has now changed that it's an indictable offence.
She's a fine solicitor. That's Gemma, isn't she?
She was quoted the other day as an eminent lawyer.
She is,
and so is Hannah. So Shane, you know, was also studying law. So I suppose, you know, we're lucky in one sense that, you know, they know the law and what should have happened, but we're also saddened that they studied the law and it wasn't implemented for the brother, and the law wasn't enforced for the brother. And it's a great tribute to Shane that they spoke up for him, and, you know, and continue to do so, and that reflects the love of our family for each other. We are a very close family.
That's the driver, love. Yeah. But listen, Lucia, thanks so much, and we send our best to your husband Jim as well, and all the four daughters, as Hannah and Gemma we mentioned, but Amy and Pia as well, and I know there's grandchildren along the way too.
Yes, thank you. And also, can I just say, Oliver, that you know, we've now put the issues that have been, we've been stonewalled by various state agencies throughout this process, and, you know, you get letter back, I acknowledge receipt of your letter, but your question isn't answered, etc. So we would hope that in our campaign and what we've achieved now, you know, it hasn't brought Shane back. It will never bring Shane back, but it's a recognition by the state that Shane has failed. But we would hope that other families wouldn't be treated like we've been treated. We'd hope that there was a sea change now for by the Department of Justice, by various state agencies, to listen to victims, to have them at the centre of everything, to wrap their arms around them and say, what can I do for you? What answers can I give you? Because when you lose a child, you lose everything. You know, time is over. It's the time left is unwanted. So it shouldn't be a huge hurdle for families to get answers. But you know, there is a few unanswered questions, and I suppose it's at the gift of the state now to say, of course.
Unanswered questions, the fight goes on. But in the meantime, Lucia O'Farrell, thank you so much for joining us, and take care.
Thank you very much, Oliver. Thank you. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Email oliver@rte.ie.
On Inishmore, everything is built on stone. Roads, walls, even footballers. And the odd hurler.
Tony Kelly, the magician.
We might be the last stop on the map from Croke Park, but the dream here is exactly the same.
A two-pointer to win it for Galway.
Win or lose, there's always another game.
Over the bar! Incredible!
You just roll on.
The GAA on RTE. Roll on the championship.
The Harvey Norman Big Sale is now on, with deals on laundry appliances. Get the Bosch Series 6 10kg washing machine featuring Eco Silence Drive for a quiet wash. Was 629, now 619. Pair with the energy-efficient Bosch Series 6 9kg heat pump tumble dryer for perfect drying. Was 859, now 839. Buy both and get a €100 Harvey Norman gift card. With our best price guarantee, why shop anywhere else? The Harvey Norman Big Sale is now on.
And you're welcome back. An incredible woman, Lucia O'Farrell, and some of the lines she wrote. She's like a novelist herself in some way, isn't she? Talking about losing a child and how the time has gone and the time left unwanted. There are a couple of messages there, but I will come back to them before the end of the programme, because I want to go somewhere else, which I promise at the top of the programme, because Elaine Feeney's third novel is out. It's called Let Me Go Mad In My Own Way. Great title. Her previous one, How to Build a Boat, as you know, was nominated for a Booker Prize. And now she's looking at an Irish family home across three generations. There's violence, there's certainly horses, and English fellas wandering into Galway with no idea what's in store for them. Elaine Feeney is here to tell us all about it. Congratulations on the novel.
Thank you, and thanks for having me.
You're very, very welcome. Let Me Go Mad In My Own Way. It almost sounds like an expression, an Irish thing we'd say, but no, it's from the classics,
it
I
is,
gather.
It is, it's actually, yeah, it's very old. It's from Electra, so we can blame Sophocles, and it's a translation by Anne Carson. But it really, yeah, it's a kind of, there's an Irish kind of shtick to it a little bit, I think.
The Greeks knew us
they
so
did.
Well.
Yeah, well, the Greeks knew tragedy and madness. And the great
Sophocles,
chorus.
He's the great tragedy writer. So like, you're straight into that. Going, yeah, I'll find something here. And is it, let me know, let you know this or something. Is that the full phrase?
Yeah.
Let me go mad. Yeah. I can tell you this.
Yeah. Well, there's many, many different translations, but absolutely.
Of course,
yeah.
That's the one you stick to.
Yeah.
Tell us about the road that you grew up in, because I think that's the inspiration, isn't it? As it often is for you.
It is. It is. I've been sort of, you know, in the same space for quite some time now with these novels. I may never move out of them. But yeah, so I bought the bungalow that I grew up in my 20s, yeah. And for better or worse, decided to stay there and see if I could write the West in a way. I don't know if I thought about it in that sort of lofty sense at that time. I think maybe I just was, you know, interested in moving back home. And there have been many generations, and I say many because I don't actually know how many, and I don't want to know, interestingly. That's, yeah. So my grandparents had lived on that road, my parents, cousins, and so on. So, yeah.
The farms. This is East Galway.
This is East Galway,
with its turf cutting along the nice kind of...
tractors, hay.
Damp hedges, but nice and warm, because it's different from the... completely different to West Galway, isn't it?
It's very different.
It's inland.
Yeah. It's inland, yeah. So it's very green and it's very inland, and obviously... You know, I like the space. And I hadn't looked at Athenry before for a novel. You know, How to Build a Boat, I set it in a fictional town near the sea, as you were. I stuck it in a hospital. So for this novel, I really wanted to write what I knew and stories of what I knew.
It's like a trilogy for you, these, aren't they?
Yeah.
Institutions, is it?
Yeah, yeah. So I'm obsessed with institutions and buildings and people and putting people into institutions and seeing what happens to them. So the first one was a hospital setting, and it was strangers in a meet in As You Were. And then in How to Build a Boat, it's a boy in a Catholic school, quite an oppressive school, and I was interested in him in that space. But in Let Me Go Mad My Own Way, I really wanted to interrogate the idea of the kitchen and the idea of the kitchen space in a house as the most political. So I think I worked up to weirdly the most political space, except that we never think of it like that.
No, it's totally unexpected here, but it is the place. And you're fascinated by those farmhouses where you opened the front door, you were straight into the kitchen.
Correct.
And then we had the bungalow. I presume, is that what you grew up in, a bungalow?
Yeah, 1970s bungalow. And I am upset. So obviously the old house is there, and this is very present in the story. So the old houses are dotted across the West.
Yes.
And I'm fascinated by how many of them have never been knocked. Or, you
That's
know, moved.
Right. Yeah.
You know, I went on a mad trip to Clare with my husband recently. We were walking in the Burren, and I met him stop at any of the abandoned ones. And I won't lie now, I did do a little bit of snooping inside. They were abandoned. It was okay. It was a lovely hot day. I just said, I'm lost. I'm looking for the loo. And
because they're kind of sheds now, aren't
they? Yeah, they are sheds.
But nobody tore them down.
No. No, and the Hessian sacks in some of them, and 10, 20 bags and others. And
wonders inside.
Yeah, and bungalows beside them. So you had these houses, and exactly what you said, they had the open kitchen, they had the loft where children slept, and then they built these bungalows in the early 70s. You know, Fintan O'Toole wrote about this in The Bungalow Nation in one of his books.
Yeah.
I didn't really understand that, but I'm fascinated by how we made the room smaller.
That's right.
Do you know what I mean? Yeah. It's like we went into individualism before we knew what capitalism was.
You're dead right.
You know,
we were mad for the front room.
Correct.
The good room, the hallway. And then the kitchen's out the back all of a sudden. It's a total reversal.
So the first thing I did when I bought the bungalow, well, it wasn't the first thing, when I saved a bit, I knocked the walls and made the big kitchen space.
You were ahead of your time. You said you were in your 20s when you got your family home.
Yeah.
And you bought it.
I did. That's very important.
Very important. You mentioned that.
I think I have the mortgage till I'm 97.
No privilege here, I can tell you.
No, I didn't really understand the generational wealth thing. I think we're all learning about that now. Yeah.
Maybe that's West Galway. No, they'll be on to us as well. No, definitely not. Mayo.
No comment.
No comment, exactly. And that's the character in this story, Claire. She goes back to her home place as well, but obviously more complicated things have happened to her than have happened to you. Yeah. Tell us what goes on from the get-go.
Yeah, so Claire O'Connor is living her life in London, and her mother dies in the West in some sort of weird, unusual circumstances. It comes as a bolt from the blue. Mm-hmm. This happens very quickly, so I'm giving nothing away. This is the setup. And she returns for the funeral. And then she goes back to London, and she's living in London with Tom, her boyfriend, her partner of a decade. And she goes back to London to Tom, and she sets her life on fire. She doesn't realise it's grief and anger, and she hears her father is ill. She returns to the West to mind him and look after him. And then she's left alone in the bungalow. And she has, you know, she has, like I said, set her life on fire. So she's left Tom, who is a very unknowable individual, you know, London Tom.
A writer.
And he's
Where did you find the inspiration?
I don't know. And he's writing about extreme sports and ultra sports and men who take part in ultra sports. So that kind of fascinates me, you know. Tom's looking for energy in all the stories and there's, yeah. Anyway, she returns back and she's faced with this bungalow on her own. She has two brothers and the past unravels through just the objects, just her in the bungalow in that space, finding things from her parents. And she starts to have conversations with them that she never had in her life, if that makes sense. She didn't really face it.
Yeah.
And she's confused. You know, Claire is quite confused, a confused character. And I suppose in some ways she's representative of the upward mobility and the progressiveness and the moves, the leaps that Ireland have taken with regards to women and agency and autonomy. She has money. Mm-hmm. She's a lecturer. She has a job. And so she's in the house. And where does she walk herself? You have all this freedom. And where she walks herself? Onto the internet. Into a deep dive on the
great sequences where you sum up the rubbish that we're all watching. From, but she becomes fixated on the tradwives phenomenon on TikTok. Explain that to the uninitiated.
Well, the tradwives, well, I don't know, do I need to explain it? But I was getting, you know, these algorithms. So I was interested in, you know, I was looking at Claire and I was saying, what would a woman do locked in this bungalow? Because it was lockdown when she was in it. Mm. And I said, of course, she'd scroll the internet. And you're absolutely right. And I said in the last novel, the Vanta black hole of the internet that we all go into. And it's just fascinating. I will get to the tradwives, sorry. But it's just fascinating. No, but you're just scrolling and you're scrolling at such extreme violence and such horrific scenes. And then you come to this woman making a lemon tart in a pink apron. You know, and it, I don't know, it just fascinated me. And what fascinated, so the tradwife movement is particularly an American thing, but they believe in the conservative values of traditional womanhood, which I do not espouse. But
shock horror. But it's kind of 50s, isn't it? That
it's
50s
very
image of
the
America.
50s, and the picket fence idea.
Your man will look after you. You just look after him and everything will be grand.
Do you remember that domestic science book? Were you familiar with it? Where put a ribbon in your hair when your husband is coming in and have the dinner on the table.
I went to an all boys school. So they didn't give us
that. One for 20 years.
Yeah. They didn't give us that. Up in the Louis Convent, maybe they did.
Well, the boys, when I was teaching them in the boys school, I remember saying, you know, it's just such a shock how women's history isn't included on the history course and is such a small minority. And they said, bless, maybe they teach it across in the girls' school.
Oh my God, the same thing I said.
Anyway, so that's the tradwife movement. So Claire gets involved. Yeah. Now, she's looking for some sort of control of her own life. Mm-hmm. And I think, interestingly, you know, I'm very on the fence. I had a really big idea of what I thought of tradwives.
Oh yeah.
And I won't use the language on the radio. But then when I went on my deep dive.
Oh no.
No, I, yeah, but I just thought again, it's about agency. Maybe they're monetizing it. Maybe it's control. Who am I to comment?
I see that view.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
And because they're playing an act. So maybe the joke is on the people who think it's a great idea, but the ones who are enacting it are actually getting something out of it for themselves.
I think that's really, yeah, apt actually, because I think we have, you know, there can be an arrogance to looking at this and then you see 10 million followers and you can 10 million followers be wrong? I have 7. You know, like, but it is this idea, but what are they looking for? Control. And then there's an awful lot of taking things out of packages, putting them into cupboards, fixing things. And but Claire gets into
she
that.
Really
she tries
does.
To control
Labeling
her life.
Labelling everything in the presses. I love it.
Yeah, she does. Yeah.
She's an amazing cook because
she is.
Somehow, like, I think we need a dinner party to discuss the novel because there's so much eating that goes on.
Yeah, I needed to write the great West of Ireland dinner party. So obviously the story culminates, it goes across 3 timelines that we can talk about, but it kind of comes
from
to
black and tans to trad wives. There's so much fun in between here, but also
a lot of sadness,
deep stuff.
Yeah. But the dinner party scene, I did think, like, I had watched Andrew Scott and Uncle Vanya, and I was like, well, if the Russians can prance around, we certainly can now with our upward mobility and our Prosecco and Cremant.
Did you travel to see that? That's where he plays every role.
No, they live streamed it to, I think it was the Palau Cinema, because they did it with the Seagull as well. They used to live stream the National, but he was fantastic in it.
Oh, amazing, I heard.
So absolutely outstanding. And I went back to check off, but actually there isn't a dinner party scene in Uncle Vanya, really. There's food and a lot of conversation. And here I was going, well, of course, I will set a table.
You will do a dinner.
In the bungalow.
Yeah.
And let's see what happens. And yeah.
But the clash of people who come, because you've got English Tom, you've got the nice stoic man next door, the farmer.
Joe.
And because you work in academia yourself,
you're in
Old School in Galiva, University of Galway.
Do
you know people who talk like the characters of that dinner party?
Absolutely not. I have an amazing imagination and everything I write is fictional. Nobody that I know is interesting enough to put in my novels.
Talking down to a farmer who's obviously keeping his intelligence to himself.
Correct.
About the patriarchy.
Correct.
And primogeniture, is that how you say
that
word?
Yeah, the inheritance rights.
The first
born son, Yeah, another little...
Favourite word of the thing. Primogeniture.
Yeah.
Very good.
Well
done. Love it. Yeah. Nearly did it.
But it is, but actually I am interested in that. I'm interested in that in the west of Ireland. I had a conversation with a friend of mine. She's an amazing comedian and she's a farmer. And there's four daughters in the family. And we had this conversation and her father doesn't even see that she could maybe perhaps inherit the family farm. And I said, is that to do with name? And this actually affects Claire also in the novel. She has the bungalow, but it's shared with the brothers. Yeah. And Joe next door has rented out the land. Mm-hmm. And she said, I think it has to do with name. I think it has to do with the name. You know, I did write in something, you have your husband's name or your father's name.
Yeah.
And I mean, that
we were talking about surnames only
yesterday,
and how it's the male inheritance thing. And there is that, we need to keep the line going.
Yeah.
Why? No one even asks. Just no, that's the way it's been. That's the way it is.
And people do it. And it really shocks me. Anyway. So the name. So I suggested maybe they need to start calling farms names, you know, name the farm.
Yeah, yeah.
And allow, you know, the women farmers to have their
space.
The
Brits do that, don't they?
I'm not here to discuss the Brits' inheritance.
Well, there's an amazing sequence in the book involving the horse. We go back to 1990 and some men have arrived and the local Irish, Anglo-Irish gentry, I think, as well.
Correct.
To recruit a horse for the Queen's Horse Guards. Mm-hmm. But it sets up the kind of the father's brute madness towards the women in the house. You grew up around horses. Mm-hmm. What was the significance of that moment in the novel?
I was fascinated when I grew up around horses. So it sounds very lofty and bourgeois to grow up around horses. But actually, you know, there was a tradition of having a horse.
Yeah.
I was very close to my grandparents, my paternal grandparents were rural Ireland. They lived beside us. My grandfather had a pony and a cart. It's like something from Heaney.
It's great. Yeah.
I know. And we used to draw water. I'd go in the cart with them and talk to them all day. And so I loved horses from a very young age. And so there was always a horse on the farm and my grandfather couldn't drive. So I used to ask him things about the land and he'd tell me, don't mind asking those questions. And I said, where did you get these fields, you know? And he said, from Lamperts below there. And he just used to wave his hand. And this was the big house that backs onto the piece of land that my father has now inherited. And so the hunt with the Galway Blazers was a thing growing up. And I'm vehemently anti-blood sports now. But when you're a child, you have no agency around what you get involved in.
Yeah.
And so local farmers would also hunt alongside the Anglo-Irish, you know,
they could dress how they liked.
Motley crew.
That's interesting. Yeah, didn't notice that bit myself.
And so I experienced this from a young age and I had no idea about colony, class, what it meant, inheritance, the black and tans. No. I knew in school that we were very lucky that great men saved Ireland from 800 years of oppression and Ireland was great and I must be very thankful. And that's what I felt deeply and a really deep sense of pride in that.
And the violence ended as well.
Oh, it all.
When we got rid of them.
Oh, we did. Yeah. We walked ourselves into a few decades of incredible violence.
Yeah.
And so the horse really is just a kind of a symbol of that Ireland and how these people mixed and how assimilation happens and how it's not as clear cut as dividing. And as I started to get older and started to read McGahern, actually Maeve Binchy's echoes in the town and on. Yeah. And I thought, this is unusual. This is strange. They do, you know, they wore hairnets and stuff. And they seem to have a lot of power in this hunt situation. Mm-hmm. So there was a hierarchy, I felt. We were at the back, the farmer's children.
It's 1990.
I know. Like,
it's very surprising, but it feels totally true.
It was the kind of the end tail, I felt, of that. You know, there were people on that hunt with titles.
Yeah.
Lady.
Right.
Yeah.
Still now, holding on to them. From whom?
Yeah, but just I was fascinated by it. But yeah, the father thinks, hopefully the father will sell a horse to the Queen of England. This big rumour goes around the town that the Queen of England is coming to Athenry to buy horses for the Queen, as if she's coming herself. And it's going to be the kind of their freedom. It's going to be their upward mobility. It may save the family. It may save the farm. And they take a special interest in his black mare. And that sequence of 1990 really helps us understand Claire's stagnant confusion in her life. She hasn't faced that event.
No.
And so we see it then from the third person. And then later on, we will see it in from a different
completely
perspective.
Different.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's really clever. I also was interested in how the townspeople essentially act the fool, don't they, to impress these fellas.
The chagrin.
Coming in.
Dion Boucicault is like, hop. Yeah, well, it's the kind of that idea of language. You know, when you're under oppression, words are your weapon, you know. And so that is, there's a legacy of that, I think. There's a legacy of language, of subversion, of kind of not saying what you want, the half-talk code of mystery and the wink and elbow language of delight, sort of.
Beautiful Kavanagh.
Yeah, but when I read Kavanagh, I was like, you're so right. But he was talking about, you know, townspeople. But I mean, we have to also include, you know, God, I'm giving you all the literary Yeats is sort of fumbling in the greasy till and the petty bourgeois of the Irish Catholic middle class.
It's all in there. I should also say it is great crack this.
Yeah, novel. Please. Thank you. Okay, I've turned everybody off with
this. Poor old Tom. I mean, I particularly love the bit, he spots the mad picture of the Sacred Heart with the light underneath him. And he says, Jesus, it's like a bulb. It's like a bulb you'd find in a whorehouse. And I'm going,
that blasphemy.
This Sassenach has offended us. But well, the poor man doesn't know what he's talking about. Does he? He's just, this is all new to him.
He doesn't, but he's sort of enraptured with the Irish men that go on ultramarathons and sail across oceans. And he just wants to figure them out. But he really does not understand history. He doesn't have a clue and he's in this part of the world. And of course, Claire's brothers meet him and they see him as the stranger. One of them doesn't. And that all permeates the atmosphere. And I was really just exploring what it would be like for the Englishman in a town, if that makes sense. I know it sounds, plenty of us are all married and, you know, blah, blah, blah. But it was just that idea of coming in and the inheritance and going back to primogeniture and this idea that he comes in to the bungalow and the brother immediately is suspicious of him.
Yes.
And Tom is totally unknowing. He has no clue.
Yeah,
he's just cleaning up.
It kind of exposes our arrogance, a bit like the trad wives, where we have this view of the English ourselves. And then when you sort of start to realise, how would they know the dynamic of inside an Irish family home?
Yeah, but maybe they should know.
Well, that's argument.
Sorry. This sounds very binary. Like, it's not, you know. It's complicated.
Back to the crack, because Claire is very jealous of this Joanna woman.
Oh, Joanna.
Who drives a Tesla. I noticed you put it
in
there.
I had that in before.
Did you really?
All the stuff went down. Yeah.
But yeah. I think there's great comedy in how she views her and imagines a lot of
Joanna.
Her.
So Tom comes to the West. He doesn't go to Claire's house, interestingly, because they're not back together. So he's staying in Joanna's house to write his book because Joanna's helping him. And this is the interesting thing. I love this. Like, people giving people houses to actually write their books. You know, that's fascinating.
That's a great idea.
I love that. Yeah. So if any listeners want to give me a house for a summer. And then Joanna is there for part of the summer and she also visits and she has this interesting conversation with Claire in a very interesting sequence when Claire actually starts to kind of say, okay, I'm putting it up to her because she's jealous of her because she thinks maybe Tom and her are having a little fling and she starts to have feelings again for Tom. And yeah, Joanna says, I don't live here in this house. Yes. You couldn't actually live here. We summered here, a verb.
Yes.
So I think I'm going to divide people from now on.
We hate her
summered
so much.
And people who have no houses. Yeah.
There's a message, Elaine, saying, don't give away all the storyline. We want to read it. They're actually giving it to me, actually. Don't worry, we haven't given nothing away. We haven't even gone into the 1920s, which is like, that's the horror. But it's extraordinary. And you feel guilty of the kind of the thrilling nature of that sort of horror in a weird way, if you know what I mean? Because I don't think we talk about the Civil War a lot, but we actually don't go into the details of Black and Tan very often.
Or the fact, and if we go back to the kitchen from the top of the chat, that kitchen space being this intimate space, but where really violent things can happen. And today it comes into that space in the 90s also, you know, and that whole notion that the black and tans and the reprisals came into people's domestic space, into the countryside.
Yes, very good. You know, and I made the mistake of reading that bit at night.
Sorry.
But look, it's an extraordinary, a brilliant novel.
We have to try and sell it now.
Get out. You don't
just
have to
read
sell
it during the day.
This is your third one. They've loved the previous ones. They'll go again. Let me go mad in my own way is how you don't say it. Elaine Feeney, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
And shall we see you for the next one?
You will.
But Let Me Go Mad in My Own Way for the meantime.
From the North, text studio, followed by your message to 80889.
Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by It's for Women. Discover female health insurance through It's for Women.
I spent my life fighting for what I believe in, for justice, for equality, for an end to poverty, and I'm not about to stop now.
Never stop fighting for fairness. Leave a gift to Oxfam in your will. Search Oxfam Ireland Gifts in Wills or call 01672762.
RTE Radio 1.
Aiken Promotions presents
But I send her my love,
The Waterboys.
You saw the whole of
live at Three Arena Dublin, June 7th. Water from Belfast, June 8th. And live at the Marquee Cork, July 10th.
Yeah, I just found God where he always was.
Tickets available now.
Music updates on RTE Radio 1.
Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1.
And you're welcome back. An incredible woman, Lucy O'Farrell, and some of the lines she wrote. She's like a novelist herself in some way, isn't she? Talking about losing a child and how the time has gone and the time left unwanted. Jump back to Lucy O'Farrell because we got some nice messages in for her. Such admiration for Lucy and her love for Shane. What amazing tenacity she's shown. I can't imagine how much they miss him, and I hope this helps her and her family heal. Another one. What an incredible woman and mother Lucia is. So articulate, and you can feel her love for her son and family so clearly through the airwaves. There you go. And our best to the whole O'Farrell family up there in Carrickross.